Good afternoon. Good afternoon. It's time with Mike. So last time we continued talking a bit about networking. So we started with a bit of a review of, or possibly review, depending what version of CSO1 you took, of sockets. And we talked about how sockets have this read and write interface, which is the same one you expect for files, taken broadly, I mean like files on disk or the terminal, which on Unix we consider that's just a file that works a little differently than normal files on disk, but we can still have this fundamental read and write interface. And so sockets give us this read and write interface for a connection to another program, possibly on another machine. And we saw how this was set up. We had some special calls to create what we call a file descriptor to represent that open file and to set up the networking information with it. So we need to sometimes set a local address, and then we need to either request to wait for connections from some remote machine and create individual sockets for each one, or request to connect to a remote machine and make our current socket be associated with that particular connection. And we had to do all that before we could actually use the read-write interface. And then we talked a bit about UDP sockets. So we said TCP implemented all that stuff we started out with, where we have sort of reliability, we have streams of data that are split up into messages kind of invisibly to us, and we don't have to worry about that. And sometimes you might not want that, but you still want the property that your messages are routed to a particular program when they're received. You still want port numbers. And UDP is a transport protocol, so at the same layer as TCP is, that provides that functionality and pretty much nothing else. And UDP still uses the same sockets interface. The difference is, rather than read and write adding to our stream of bytes, each read and write is a separate message. And we also saw that with UDP sockets, we had some other options. So we didn't actually have to have our UDP socket associated with one remote host, because UDP doesn't actually have connections. So we could actually send to different ones from the same socket, rather than the TCP way where we had to create a separate socket for each party we were communicating with. Then we talked a bit about, we have these sockets. How is the OS figuring out when some message comes in off the network what program it goes to? And we saw that, we are tracking all these connections based on their IP addresses and port numbers. We have this big table of those, and that table is going to tell us what file descriptor and what programs we're going to need to wake up if they're, say, reading from it when we receive a message. And the OS will just maintain this big table, and you can, in fact, kind of view the contents of that table with the netstat command on many OSs. So then we talked about some application layer stuff. So talked about the domain name system. So something that wasn't complete is talked about how the network layer, given an IP address, gets the message there, but we never really, but we very rarely actually use IP addresses. Usually we use domain names, DNS names, so names in the domain name system. And mentioned that the domain name system, it's not just like one machine which has all the names. Instead, we have this kind of distributed database. And it's distributed because, different people are in charge of different sets of names. So all the virginia.edu names, the University of Virginia is in charge of. So they should run the server that handles those names. And all the cs.virginia.edu names, the CS department at the University of Virginia is in charge of. So they should run that server. And so we have a database design that fits this division of work, where kind of each set of domains has their own server, and we have some way of going from a root server, which will tell us where to find the sort of next server down the hierarchy until we eventually find the name we want. And we said, it would actually be pretty slow if we had to do this whole query every single time. So what typically happens is when you have an internet connection, the DNS server you contact is not the root server, or is not directly the server that actually stores the information. Instead, typically your ISP will run a server who's responsible for doing these queries for you. And this server will try to save you some time by remembering past results, by caching them. And they're told how long they can cache them for, and in this way avoid, you know, every time you go to www.cswunity.edu, they don't ask for it again, they just remember, oh, a few minutes ago you went to this website, I have the IP address from then, let me just give that to you again. Rather than asking over and over again. So then we talked a bit about URIs, which are kind of the general form of URLs, or uniform resource indicator, or uniform resource locator. Talked about their format. They're something you've probably seen before. Just wanted to go sort of specifically into what's there and mention that, well, they're not just for websites. They're kind of just a way of specifying something possibly on a remote machine. And then we went through some sort of missing pieces in the interaction between our link layer and our network layer. So one was that I said, oh, at the link layer, we're sending things based on MAC addresses. But typically, the way we ask something to be sent on the link layer is by trying to send something on the network layer. So there's some disconnect there, where you have to take network addresses and turn them into MAC addresses. We mentioned that on the local network, a common way of doing this is that our machines will ask everyone on the local network, hey, is this your address? And figure out that way what MAC address to send messages for a particular IP address. And we also need to figure out, well, is this address on the local network at all? And typically the way that works is that we configure the machines when you join the network to know this range of IP addresses is local, everything else, go through this guy. And they'll just know to send all the other messages to that guy. They won't ask who has it, they'll just say, well, I know it's not the local network, I'll go to this gateway machine. And we said, well, how is this all configured? And to talk about how it's configured, we talked about this idea of DHCP, that we need to have some way when we connect to a network the first time to ask the network, hey, what address should I use? And DHCP is probably the most commonly used protocol for this. And basically the way it works is we send a message to everyone saying, hey, what address should I use? And some machine that was configured on the network will respond to us saying, yep, I'm in charge of this network, here's the address you should use. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Yes? What does DHCP stand for? I do not remember. Other questions? Yes? Question, DHCP basically assigns a local IP to your machine. That is the primary thing it does. It also usually includes the rest of the network configuration you need. So I guess we didn't mention this explicitly, so I probably should mention it. So DHCP, so this assigns the local IP plus sort of the gateway machine that will be assigned and what IPs are in the network are local. And what DNS server to use. And sometimes even more information. But basically, it gets you everything you need to configure your network connection. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So let's do some brief anonymous feedback. So some comments, complaints about quizzes. Apparently I write too many word questions and, well, on the last quiz I was not super careful with the phrasing, which meant I had to add a bunch of extra things to the key after the fact, which maybe is what this complaint is about. Writing wordy questions comes from I need to write questions which aren't just mechanical things you'll look up. But, and yes, I'm maybe not as experienced writing compact questions as I should be. Another question is, can I move the quizzes until after the homeworks and or labs? So, I've been going through the post-spring break schedule, because that's the things I worry about, and there's probably going to be times when we don't cover something in homework until like a week or two after it's in lecture, just because, well, if I move the homework up, I'm worried if I go slow, I'm in big trouble, right? That would be bad. So I'm going to try to err on the other side, and we have like more assignments on some things than others. So I think there will be problems in the other direction if I waited till after homeworks, given how that scheduling is likely to work out later in the semester. And also, I think I'm going to get complaints either way, because I know there's also likely to be complaints. Why are you asking me about this thing we covered 2 weeks ago? I don't remember it. But the bigger issue is that I think I'll be waiting too long if I always wait till after we have a relevant homework. And also, sometimes we'll have like a homework on part of what we covered in lecture, and it's not clear like when I should ask about the things that weren't in the homework but are part of the same topic. So then, about the first question from the quiz this week. So on the first question for the quiz this week, we gave you the contents of a page table entry and ask you to figure out the physical address of the page table that was pointing to. It was pointing to a page table because this was a multi-level lookup. So rather than our page table entries at the earlier levels pointing to the actual data, they pointed to another page table. And this complaint was, our slide suggests we should multiply the most significant bits, which were the page number, with the page size. And great. Problem is, it wasn't the page size in the question. Well, it kind of was. It was the size of the page in page table entries, but our addresses are always in bytes, so the number you needed to multiply by was the number of bytes. And probably what was confusing the student is that the example, several of the examples I did in the lecture, because I needed to fit things on my lecture slides, I made my page table entries 1 byte. So I made them 2 bytes, my slides would be bigger and run out of space. And maybe I should try to find a way of, not having that special case on the slides, but that's probably what was confusing there. Okay. And also, some anonymous feedback on continuing issues with TA spending too long. I am talking to them about this. And also saying, hey, could the homeworks be due later in the day after the labs? So, I'm not really comfortable with doing this. I am very worried that if I set the homework due times after the labs, that I will hear from TAs, no one was really doing the lab today. They were all working on the homework. And I really want to avoid that. So maybe there's a way I can move the day times somewhere very different that would be okay, but I don't want them up against near the labs but after them, because I think that's going to lead to people just not doing the lab in effect in lab. Okay. Comments, questions on these logistical things? Okay, so last time we finished up very briefly talking about network address translation, so I'm going to just cover that briefly again. So this was for the very common scenario where we have a network that wants to use IP addresses but unfortunately doesn't have any. So this is very common in sort of a home situation where your ISP will typically give you one IPv4 address, but you have like 4 computers. Or devices which could talk to the network. Maybe they're not all computers. So we want to convert many IP addresses, private IP addresses, to a public address. So typically we'll have a router which, rather than just doing routing, does this translation where they'll maintain a table of open connections where the open connections will have a different IP address and port on the outside network than on the inside network. And this intermediate router machine, instead of just forwarding the packets directly, is going to have to adjust these port numbers and IP addresses as they come in or go out of the local network. And network address translation, so it's really common and comes up all the time and is unfortunately like really complicated actually. And one way it's really complicated is that it's a case where I told you all about this nice layered model. Network address translation just throws that away. It violates all the layers, right? We're doing routing, which is supposed to be a network layer thing, like figuring out what machine to get the data to across networks. We're doing routing, but because we ran out of addresses, we're doing it at the transport layer. It's at the transport layer because we're dealing with port numbers. Those don't exist at the network layer. But network address translation is this kind of annoying hack that has to violate the layers to work. And it's everywhere. Okay, so questions on network address translation? Okay, so our next big topic is going to be about secure communication. And we're going to talk about secure communication mostly on a network, but all these same principles apply in contexts where a network is not involved. So for example, if I'm trying to keep stuff secure on a disk, we can think of that as a really funny network where the way I send a message on the network is I store something on a disk, and the way I receive a message is I read something from a disk. And all these same principles will apply to that kind of scenario. We're going to try to talk abstractly about people communicating. Sort of the generic term you'll see in the literature is principles. And I'm going to use a running example of A talking to B. A could be a person, a program, whatever. We're not going to really care. And B will also be that. And also, we're going to be concerned about security, so there has to be some sort of party that is acting against our interests. And I'm going to have sort of two types of attackers. So we're going to have an eavesdropper we're going to be worried about. And this is thinking about like someone who's a passive attacker. So think of if we're on the same Wi-Fi, someone who can read all the Wi-Fi signals but isn't sending anything. Or someone who somehow taps into our router but doesn't interfere with it in any way. And we'll also be concerned about an active attacker. So I'll use M to represent them, and man in the middle. And they get to have more control over our network. So they potentially get to read all the messages, but also replace them, insert their new messages, add new messages. They can do whatever. Think of them as someone malicious is programming your router, or you didn't connect to the Wi-Fi access point you wanted, you connected to a different one. And that can send whatever it wants to you. And so we'll say that these attackers, sometimes you're going to say they're in a privileged network position. So they might be intercepting your radio signals. They might just control the Wi-Fi router. They might have compromised some router somewhere else through some security flaw in it, or like just a bad password. Also, this includes some scenarios where, they're not compromising your network directly, but they're taking advantage of how open the public network is. So for example, you can send packets with the wrong source address. So we saw that in IP, like we had a source address in our packets. That's just data there. You can put other things there, and the only question is, who's going to forward it for you? So hopefully, your ISP won't let you do that, won't let you put anything there and send it to the network, but some ISPs aren't so careful. Or another example might be, maybe we can confuse a DNS server to take over virginia.edu. We have some other DNS server think, oh, virginia.edu is actually my server, not the real one. that might be something we can do remotely. So if the DNS server isn't somehow verifying it gets the response from the right place, maybe it would get fooled into returning to some user the wrong address. Or we might be able to fool routers to route the data incorrectly. So maybe the problem isn't that the router is like in our control, but that the router gets confused about what network it should send the information to, because we sent something that was not quite the right configuration. We somehow fooled them into misconfiguring it. So it doesn't have to be the attacker has like direct control over your network. There's lots of ways this could happen. We're going to kind of speak abstractly about, we're just assuming somehow the attacker has gotten some control. There's lots of things that could happen, and we want to protect against all of it. Okay, so that's secure against who and for who. But something we haven't mentioned that's also going to be important is what secure for what. And there's two big properties we're going to be focusing on, and I want to emphasize that these are not the only things you could care about. And they're going to be kind of confidentiality, meaning that the information is only shared with the people who should have it. So people who shouldn't have information don't get it. And also authenticity, that when we receive a message, it was really sent by the person it appeared to come from. It wasn't manipulated in some way. It's actually what they intended to send us at the time they intended to send it to us. We aren't being fooled in some way into thinking something they were sending us is something else. And as I said, these aren't the only things we could care about. So for example, another property you might care about is that if I send you a message, that you can't go and then prove that I sent you that message to someone else. I'd say, why would I care about this? Well, if you think about, let's say, making a secure chat program, it would actually be pretty annoying if when someone copy and pasted our conversation, that you couldn't say that's fake. If using a secure chat program meant now they can prove you said that to anyone else, your private conversation. And so that's actually something that secure chat programs worry about, is making that not providing reputability, that you can't prove that I actually sent you the message any better than sort of you could prove that you called me on the phone and I said something. Like, yes, you have evidence, but you're not going to have like a mathematical proof, which often you'll get by accident when you're doing authenticity here. Another is forward secrecy. So this is something that's actually very important, is that if my machine is compromised now, I don't want it to be the case that all my past conversations are now public. So that's like a real big practical concern, and it's not something we're really going to talk about how you achieve, but a lot of real systems try to achieve that property. Just because things get compromised all the time, we don't want to have to like redo everything when it happens. Another might be anonymity. So we're kind of going in the opposite direction with all this authenticity stuff, but sometimes we might want you to not be able to tell where a message comes from. We're not going to talk about that sort of thing. And there's a whole bunch of other things you might come up with that you want to try to have happen as far as how our communication works, that you could consider security properties, things we want to have happen despite adversaries trying to break it, despite adversaries trying to de-anonymize, figure out who the message comes from, or prove that the message, that we really sent that message and they didn't make it up. And so on. Okay, so we have these security properties. And we're going to go to our main, start with confidentiality and have A talking to B. And a problem we have is that we need some way, some reason why M, our active attacker, can't pretend to be B. So there needs to be something different about M and B. Because with what we said so far, M can do absolutely everything B can do. So there needs to be something that distinguishes them. And the key assumption we're going to make is that B knows some information that M does not. And that's why B is going to be able to do things that M will have no way of doing. So we want to take advantage of the fact that B knows something and kind of expand that to letting us have this secure communication. And for our first version of this, we're going to have some different setups later. We're going to assume that A and B in advance have a shared piece of secret information they set up. So something kind of akin to a password. And that our attackers don't have this information. And you might very legitimately complain, if we can do this, why are we bothering? We'll talk about that maybe a little more later, but there's not a hugely satisfying answer. So let's talk about something that doesn't work. Hey, A to B, what's the password? B to A, here it is. Okay, here's the confidential information. So this just doesn't work against either of our attackers. You know, E just got the password and the info. And M could do even better. M can pretend to be A, B can't tell the difference, and get the password, even if A hasn't asked for it. So this really doesn't work. So we're going to want something that does work using our shared secret here. And our solution's going to be math. And I'm not going to go into how any of this math works. And the main reason why is I could go into kind of an abbreviated version, but it turns out if you try to use the abbreviated version, you probably will be missing some details that, while not important for understanding the basics of how it works, are important for making it secure. So rather than deal with that, I'm going to talk about this at a higher level, and our assumption is that if you need to do this, you'll use someone's good implementation of these tools. So we're going to have what we'll call symmetric encryption. We'll see why I'm using the word symmetric later, because we're going to have an asymmetric version. And we're going to be given two functions. So both these functions will take a key and something else. We'll have an encrypt function, we'll call E, which will take a key and a message, and give us what we'll call a ciphertext. And we'll have a decrypt function, which will take the same key and the ciphertext and give us back the message. And the key is going to be probably your shared secret, or something very related to it. And the reason why this is going to be beneficial, why is it going to be worth sharing the secret, is that this key can be very small relative to the messages we encrypt. So it's going to be a lot easier to share that key than it is to share the big messages we're going to end up encrypting. Yes?
So how would we first get the key? Would A send it before sending any messages at the beginning of the conversation?
So the question is, how would B get the key in the first place? So we'll talk about one concrete mechanism probably next time that might be practical in practice, but probably the simplest way we can imagine is that A and B meet in person somewhere, say, I'm going to want to talk in the future, and they share it then in person, and then later on, they're all set for communicating over the network. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have these functions, and kind of the intuition is that the encrypt function scrambles the message using the key in some way, and the decrypt function sort of unscrambles it. And we want the people who do all the math on this to guarantee us that even knowing the encrypt and decrypt functions, you can't figure out anything about the message from its ciphertext. And in fact, it should be hard in the sense that it should be basically as hard as guessing every possible key. Right, that should be basically your best strategy should be you try every possible key there is. And the good encryption functions, it is actually about that difficult as far as we can tell. Like, we don't have a proof because they're like P equals NP issues, but practically speaking, it seems to be basically as hard as trying every possible key. And if our keys are big enough, there's too many of them to do that. And actually, like, we need properties which are even stronger than this. So learn anything about the key. Well, what does that mean? That means, like, message. That means not only should I not be able to know what the message is, I shouldn't be able to, like, guess anything about, like, whether the message starts with an A or not. Better than chance. And actually needs to be stronger than that. So in addition to not being able to figure out the message, I shouldn't be able to figure out the message or the key, even given a whole bunch of messages where I know how they decrypt. So what we call known plaintext. So even if I know a whole bunch of messages, that won't help me with the next one. And even if I get to choose what those other messages are, that shouldn't help me. And also, even if I know a whole bunch of messages encrypted under keys that are similar, that are like the same key plus one, still shouldn't help me. And actually, a whole bunch of other properties we often expect like this. So a good encryption function is going to be hard to reverse in like a very strong sense. That's why it's going to be a useful tool. So hard to reverse both the message or the key. And also, like, knowing partial info about the message won't help us decrypt it either. Like, if we know, like, everything but in the message but one byte, we should still be only able to do as good as guessing that one byte. And I'm mentioning these properties because sort of a lot of sort of classical encryption you might know, like, doesn't have these, but sort of modern encryption functions, this is the strength we are looking for, is that, you know, we can give you a lot of information and you still can't figure out things about a ciphertext without the key. So how would we end up using this? So in Vance, we share this encryption key. And then when A wants to send the message to B, they compute their encrypted value, and they send that over the network. Then B computes the decrypted value, recovers the original message. Everything's great. Questions about our use case here? Yes?
When A sends to B on the network, is that encrypted as well?
Question, when A sends to B on the network, is that encrypted as well? So on the network, I told you the output of the E function was the stars, so that's what we're sending.
Why don't they add another, like, I guess, extra security, like, encrypt on the network, and when B receives it, decrypt before sending, before B getting actual, I guess, ciphertext.
So question, why do we add?
Like, why wouldn't we add another, like, layer of encryption, I guess? Would it be more secure?
Would it be more secure if we add another layer of encryption? So assuming our encryption function meets these properties, it should be impractical already for any attacker to figure anything out. And if it's already impractical, I wouldn't say it's more secure under that model. Under, you know, the model where we assume they already don't have enough information, you know, having another layer of encryption, well, doesn't matter whether or not they break that other layer. Yes, and I'm sorry, the question was, could we add another layer to increase the security? So other questions? Yes, back there.
How do modern, like, when they're making the encryption, how do they know that it's good enough to not, like, be broken easily?
Question, when they make the encryption, how do they know it's good enough to not be broken easily? So I'm not an expert cryptographer, and very few people do this, but my basic understanding is that they have a lot of experience knowing how prior encryption functions have been broken. So that's one way they figure it out. There's a number of attacks where they can kind of prove that a certain style of way attacking won't work. And they can also kind of look empirically at statistical properties, so that's not the main thing you do. But the main thing, I think, is they know how things have been broken in the past, and they try to prove that their new things, like, cannot be broken in those ways, and also have an intuition for what are likely mechanisms for attack that they're also trying to avoid. Does that answer your question? Other questions, follow-ups? Okay, so seems great. We have secure communication. And it might seem like we just need encryption. That if B receives a message from A, everything's great. If it makes sense when we decrypt it, we're good. But there's a problem here, and that the problem is that our active attacker can actually manipulate these encrypted messages, despite how strong our encryption is, in selective ways. I'd say, why is this the case? Like, it's scrambled, how can I change it? And to talk about that, I'll talk about sort of one common way encryption functions are constructed. So one common approach, not the only one, is that we want to encrypt something. We'll take a random number and the shared secret, and we'll use it to generate a long string of hard-to-guess bits. And then we'll take the bytes of our message and XOR them bit by bit with that long string of hard-to-guess bits. And then our ciphertext is going to be the random number we chose and the XOR bits. And what this means is that if I want to flip a bit in the message we decrypt, I can just flip one of these C bits here to flip the corresponding bit of the original message when it's decrypted. This means that me, as an attacker, I can flip individual bits in the message, even though I don't know what the message is, I can still do that. And in many practical situations, you know, even though we can't figure out what the message is by decrypting it, we can figure out what the message is from other contexts. So if I know the message reads like pay dollar amount to Bob, I can probably figure out what bits I want to flip to make that number bigger. We can also do things like shorten the message. And if I know there's information I don't want to get to the other side, maybe the message will still make sense if I'm careful about how I do it. Or I can just randomly corrupt parts of the message and see what A does, and try to figure out what the message is doing based on that. So we're going to need a solution to this, to solve this problem that encryption doesn't solve. And one solution we're going to start with is something called message authentication codes, or MACs. And here we're going to use another key that usually will be a different key than the one we use for encryption, but it's not really important whether or not it is. And we're going to have a function we use that takes the key in the and some message and gives us what we'll call a tag, which is kind of going to be like a hash. And similar to what you imagine with a hash, the idea is that if we don't have the key, we can't make a message with the same tag. And also, if we don't have the key, we can't figure out what the tag should be for a different message. So this is going to give us a way of verifying that someone who has the key produced this tag using that particular message and not something else. And so conceptually, this looks very much like a checksum. But kind of the difference is that this is a checksum with a key, that we get a different checksum function whatever key we use, and you can't reproduce that checksum function unless you have the key. And also, unlike a checksum, we're not trying to protect against accidents. These are going to be designed to protect against someone who's malicious manipulating the message, which means that they're going to be probably a lot slower and also longer to do that. But it serves a similar purpose to a checksum, except we have a key associated with it to make it tied to that secret information. So let's say we're using this without encryption. A way that might work is we'll have our MAC key shared in advance, our key for this message authentication code. And when we're sending a message, we're going to compute the tag for the message, and we're going to send it along with the message. And when B receives the message, they're going to check the tag, they're going to recompute the MAC, and if it doesn't match, they're just going to reject the message. Say, nope, you didn't send me the right one. And we can also combine this with encryption. Generally, the way we do that is we'd encrypt the message, and then we take our encrypted message and apply the message authentication code to that and send them both. And when we process the message, we're going to check the tag first. And if the tag doesn't match, we just don't decrypt it. We know it's not the right thing. Yes?
If we use different keys for the message and the tag, how do we know where one starts and where one ends and the next?
The question is, when I'm sending the message on the network here, how do I know where the encrypted data starts and the tag ends and the tag begins? My assumption is that either the tag is a fixed size, so we figure it out from that, or there's some header information I'm not showing here to indicate that. Does that answer your question? Yes.
What happens if you manipulate the checksum of the MAC itself, and then wouldn't that be in like another 400 information?
So the question is, what happens if I manipulate the checksum of the packet itself? So you're saying, we know that when this is sent over the network, it's going to be sent in packets that have their own checksums. Can't we manipulate that? Absolutely. And it's not going to matter, right? Because either we manipulate the checksum so the message doesn't get sent properly, or we manipulate the checksum and the message does get, you know, and the message gets there, but it gets there with the wrong data, in which case when we check the tag, when B checks the normal, this special key tag, it's not going to work. So a key property that sort of all these encryption things we're using have is that they're what we'll call end-to-end. That they don't care what happens in between, because we're verifying, assuming that everything in between we can't trust. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So that's probably maybe something I should have emphasized more, is that I'm talking about doing encryption between A and B, where A and B basically trust nothing else. That's going to be okay. Couldn't M still mess with the bits of the tag? Yes. And if they do so, they're just going to make B reject the message. But they could already do that by dropping the message from the network. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How does B get the tag in the first place?
How does B get the tag in the first place? The message we send includes the encrypted data and the tag together.
So what if M just changed the tag when it was sent?
Question, what if M just changed the tag that was sent? Then it wouldn't then B wouldn't be able to verify it. So B's code for receiving a message is get a tag and check it. And if that doesn't work, we stop. So anything M does to manipulate the tag or remove it, it's going to make B not, just not accept the message as if like the network wasn't working. Does that answer your question?
How does B get the tag in the first place to verify the tag hasn't
been? Oh, question, how does B get the tag in the first place? B also has the MAC key, so it can recompute the function that A computed. Is that, that's the question you were getting at. Okay, yes. So the important step here is that in advance, they share the keys, so they both can recompute the MAC. Yes, back there? Yeah, so the assumption here, the question is how did A and B get the MAC key? The assumption here is that when we're sharing those keys, we share both an encryption key and a MAC key. So, wanting to do this kind of thing is extremely common, so common in fact, that often you'll see like libraries and tools provide authenticated, something called authenticated encryption, which is usually encryption and a MAC packaged together. Questions? Are
verify MAC in this context has nothing to do with MAC addresses.
Question, MAC in this context has nothing to do with MAC addresses? That is correct. Just an unfortunate naming collision. Okay. So we've talked about doing secure communication with shared secrets, but often this isn't really practical. So one issue here is it seems like I need secure communication to do secure communication. And sadly, we're not going to be able to completely fix this problem. A bigger issue is we have some scaling problems. That if I want my browser to communicate to any website securely, and there's like a billion browsers copies on, and a million websites, it seems like somehow we need to construct trillions of keys. That doesn't seem practical. It's just, and it's also hard to talk to new people. So we're going to have some solutions for that that's going to make it easier to set up. And we're going to use some mathematical tools that are going to let us take some nice shortcuts. And one of them is that we're going to be able to set up this secure communication in a way where rather than having a private conversation to set up our keys, we're going to be able to make a broadcast conversation that I can just tell everyone information that will let them communicate with me. So in the website context, this means that the website can tell everyone their keys, and we don't have to worry about having them tell each individual browser a different key. We're going to somehow make that secure. And also, later on, we're going to talk about, well, we still have too much work here because we have millions of websites that we need to get all the keys from. So we're going to also fix it so we have fewer parties to communicate with securely and somehow bootstrap that into communicating with more people securely. Maybe under some assumptions you won't be happy with. Yes?
By browser, do you mean applications like Firefox and Chrome, or do you mean like computers and like devices?
Question, by browser, do I mean applications like Firefox or Chrome or computers more generally? I was referring specifically to applications like Firefox or Chrome, but the same would apply to sort of your OS more generally, yes.
So how do you have billions of browsers? Is it like each copy of an application on someone's computer then?
Question, how do I have billions of browsers? Do I mean each copy of the application? Yes. Because even if the secret keys are in the application, we need to get that to them, that machine securely. Sorry. Other questions? Follow-ups? Okay. So we're going to have a primitive that I kind of previewed earlier called asymmetric encryption. And we're going to have an encrypt and decrypt, but instead of taking the same key, we're going to have two different keys, what we'll call a key pair. Encrypting, we'll use a public key, which will be public. Everyone will get to know it. And decrypting, we'll use a private key. And this is going to require much less intuitive math to construct, and we're not going to worry about how it works internally, except to say the math is more complicated. But the idea here is we have this key pair, so there's going to be this private key that we're going to keep secret. And we're going to have a public key that we give to everyone. And the public key is going to be some function of the private key. So we're going to generate a private key secretly and use that to make a public key we can give away. And this concept we're talking about with asymmetric encryption first, we're also going to use this concept of having private keys, keys we keep secret, and public keys, sort of a sort of public version of that we can give to everyone. It's going to come up in some other contexts. And the way these works is similar to encryption, that when we apply the public encrypt function, we get a ciphertext that you can't reverse without the private key. That even if you know the public key and the message, or sorry, even if you know the public key and the ciphertext, you can't figure out the message unless you get the private key. And also, of course, you know, if you know the public key and the message and the ciphertext, that doesn't help you find the private key. And generally, these are going to have similar security properties to symmetric encryption. It turns out they're going to be, because of how the math has to work, a little more unwieldy. So we're not going to be able to make it as hard as you have to try every possible key. That's just not going to happen mathematically. But it's going to be impractically hard to, you know, figure out the message from the ciphertext and the public key. And we're going to have similar worries that, you know, we want it to be hard, even if you have like lots of ciphertexts and lots of messages and you know lots of things about them. Again, you know, when these are designed well, you know, they're really going to protect it against a lot of information being available to our attacker, but not the plain text for the ciphertext that they're trying to decode. So, if we think of how these are used, what we'll do is, let's say B wants to get messages from A. So B will generate a private key and a public key, and B will send their public key to A in some secure way. And they could also send that same public key to lots of other people, because it doesn't matter, you know, for the security of only them being able to read the messages if other people also have that key. So, and then conceptually, A will just apply this function to the public key, send that message over the network, and B will decrypt it with the private key. Questions about asymmetric encryption and public keys? Yeah?
How do you prevent somebody from changing the public key?
Question, how do I prevent someone from changing the public key? So I'm making a huge assumption here when I write the word securely. And yes, if you break that assumption, nothing works. Does that answer your question? Yes.
If it's a public key and we know that these pair of keys is advanced enough that you really need to have the private key to decrypt, why does it have to send, why does B have to send the public key to A securely? Couldn't it just send, like, if anyone requests it, couldn't it just send directly? Because they can't decrypt without the private key anyway.
So the question is, why does B have to send it securely? Couldn't B just send it over the network in a normal way? And the problem is that, let's say we did that, then our active attacker M, it looks for, you know, so Alice, so A, I should say, sends a message to B saying, please give me the public key. B sends the public key, and the active attacker M looks for that message and replaces the public key in it. So we need to somehow prevent that. Does that answer your question? Yes.
If, like, multiple people have a public key, what's up one person with it from, like, impersonating somebody else with the public key?
So the question is, if multiple people have the public key, what's stop one person in it from impersonating someone else? That's a good question, and this is the same problem we have with encryption and the messages being manipulated. So we're going to have a similar solution, but we're going to want a public key version of this solution instead of a shared key version. And that's our next topic, which is going to be digital signatures. And digital signatures are the asymmetric version of message authentication codes. So they're going to provide with message authentication codes, but rather than having a single shared key, we'll have a public key for what we'll call signing messages, and private key for signing messages, private key for signing, and a public key for verifying messages. So we'll have two operations, a sign operation that produces what we call a signature, which is the same purpose as the tag in message authentication codes. So it's kind of like a checksum of the message, but with a key. And we can verify that with the public key. But we can't produce a signature that will verify correctly without the private key. So even though anyone can verify it if they have the public key, having the public key doesn't let you make new signatures. So as far as using these, I wrote this slide wrong. We'll have the actual message I meant to write. Is that if we want to send a message and have it verify where it came from, A can generate, in this case, a private key and a public key for signatures, and send the public key to B in advance somehow securely, so they know it's the A's public key and not someone else's. And then they compute the signature over the message they want to send and send that alongside the message, just like we saw computing a tag alongside a message for a Mac. And B will have to verify the signature when it receives it, and presumably if it doesn't verify, if it's not equal to one, when they run the verify function, just say, invalid, something happened. So questions about our signatures? Asymmetric version of message authentications. Okay. So it seems like, yes, sorry. V, should it be public key? Absolutely it should. Okay. I did not read this slide carefully. This is what I get for copying and pasting when making slides. Yes, sorry. V verifies with the public key because V doesn't have the private key for signing in this scenario. Other questions, comments, problems in this slide? Okay, so we have all these tools for doing confidentiality and authentication. So keeping things secret to those who are supposed to know it and verifying that, you know, we actually got the message from the right person. And you might think, okay, I'm all ready to do secure communication. And, well, it turns out that these building blocks are not straightforward to use securely. And let me illustrate some common problems that happen. And I will tell you, the state-of-the-art thing you should do if, like, you're building a commercial product is model these sort of scenarios I'm going to talk about in a formal proof system. Yes, this is really what people do because it's such a problem. And prove that bad things don't happen, you know, where you've quantified what those bad things are. We'll have some examples of what they might be later slides. So let's give an example here. Let's say we have some communication where we authenticate all the messages by signing them. So A sends to B, you know, did you order lunch? And, you know, signs the message so we know it came from A. And B sends to A, yes. Signs the message so we know it came from B. And then we have a bunch of conversation, and then much later, A says to B, hey, there's this guy at the door who says he's here to prove an EC. Should I let him in? So, exercise, what can an attacker do in this scenario that would probably not be something A and B want? So an attacker can just say, oh, here's a nice message with a signature. I can just copy paste that message right there and send it to A. And this is known as a replay attack. We are repeating a message at a time it wasn't expected. And the message now has a very different meaning than it originally had. But all the signatures work out because it was a real message we copied with a real signature that was computed really with the private key that we still don't have. Yes?
Is this to assume that the attacker has B's public key?
Question, is this to assume the attacker has B's public key? So in this scenario, the attacker doesn't even need that. Because what we're sending is we're sending message in clear text signature. So we don't even need that. Don't need anything. Like, we don't need to check the signature, we just need to know, well, A sent it, so it's probably real. Or sorry, B sent it, so it's probably a real signature. Yeah?
Wouldn't the
question, wouldn't the attacker not know what message to send back? So in the scenario I set up here, we're signing but not encrypting. So they would trivially. If it was encrypted, it would be harder, but maybe they could still figure out if they, you know, it, like, let's say you screenshotted the prior chat. They could figure it out from that, perhaps, for example. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So how can we prevent this issue? So the main solution pattern we're going to use for this is often called nonces, for numbers used once. So if we number all our messages and require the numbers to be strictly increasing, now we can no longer copy that old signature because it's not going to be valid for a newly numbered message. Now, this requires, and this is like not just a subtlety, but something that people screw up, this requires that you actually check these numbers. You can't just accept the message without looking at what the number is. But assuming you do that, that prevents us from copying that old message. And so one way is that we can like start at one and just keep going up. You might imagine maybe this number could be like timestamp comma number or something like that to keep us from having to remember like what the last number was all the time. Another approach is that we can kind of send the next number to use with the previous message and kind of choose a random number each time. Rather than incrementing, we just choose a random number each time. And in a real scenario, we choose numbers that are much bigger than this, so no, there won't be any coincidences. So we have this fix here. Can anyone think of any problems with this fix? So there's a different, very different attack scenario if we imagine that B also communicates with some other people. Do I want to send more than one message before the other person sends a message to you?
They're supposed to send you the next number, but you're sending them the next number, and then you want to send them another message.
So the question is, don't you have to send them the next number in the scheme? So what I'm assuming for the first version of the scheme is that we just increment the number that we send.
Okay, I guess I'm saying the problem with the next
scheme. So with this scheme is that you think it doesn't work so well when we send multiple messages? Yeah, that may be something we'd have to refine. I'm going to try to go with a simpler scheme. There's a problem here if we're talking to other people. Yes?
If B is talking to someone else, B can send a message that has a number that matches up with its current, with B's current place with A. And so you can copy messages from another conversation.
Yeah. So the observation is that we haven't actually signed who the message is to. That's not part of what we're signing. So if there's some other conversation B is having, we can copy messages from that conversation potentially to the conversation with A. And if you would imagine an attacker, the attacker can ask B, did you order lunch? Get a yes, copy that to the conversation with A, and arrange for the numbering to be the same. Because, well, they can just make the conversation exactly the right length to do that, or choose a next number exactly right to do that. So what we can do to fix this is that, well, actually we need to sign who the message is to. We need to sign more information. We didn't sign enough. Like the thing we signed didn't have all the context we needed. So in addition to this nonces, we're going to want to write down in the things we sign and in our messages in general, We're going to want to write down who's the message for and any other context we need to interpret the message so it can't be repurposed elsewhere. Or an alternate approach that helps with who we're sending to is that something we might do, especially with symmetric encryption, is we'll have a separate set of keys for everyone we're talking to. That way, you know, you can't copy and paste messages from the different conversations because they use different keys, they won't decrypt correctly anymore or verify correctly anymore. And I showed you like a variation of this with asymmetric encryption. The same problem happens with symmetric encryption, often with what's known as reflection attacks. So sending the message A sent to B back to A as if it came from B, if we aren't careful about indicating who it's from in the message itself, so it can't be changed by an attacker. Yes?
Can't you encrypt the message with the, because you have to a private key?
Can't I encrypt the message to a private key?
So can you encrypt the signature of the message you're sending to with the, your person you're sending to the private key?
Okay, the question is, could I deal with this problem by, when I'm sending my message to B, encrypting it to M? With including encrypting the signature. So the problem here is that I'm talking to M, my attacker, and my attacker can decrypt that. So this would limit what the attacker could do with messages from other conversations, but often you would assume the attacker can get one of the keys you're talking to, have control over one of the keys you're talking to legitimately. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. Let's talk about briefly about other attacks. So I wanted to impress upon you that, you know, we want you to know what encryption and signatures are, and there's a few other things we're going to talk about probably next Tuesday. But there's a lot of problems which happen even when we're using math that works. And I'll give two examples from real applications that are meant to do secure communication of some sort. So one is that there was an implementation of TLS, the SSL protocol, or aka TLS protocol, that's part of HTTPS, which we'll talk more about later. And that protocol works by we verify the server's identity and receive messages from the server. And some versions of some Java implementations of TLS had this bug, where what you could do as a server that was malicious is you could just send the client the message from step two of the protocol, and it would look at that message and say, oh, we must be on step two. And it would skip step one and not notice. And these sorts of problems happen probably about as often as problems with the actual cryptography. And when people try to make secure communication systems. Another example is from Matrix, which is kind of a distributed chat tool, kind of in the same functionality zone as Discord, that tries to do confidential multi-user chats. And a challenge with this is that if I'm someone who has a desktop and a phone, they're going to have separate keys because I'm going to generate a private key on each of them, and we need to share all those keys with the people I'm communicating with so they can send me messages. And the mechanism they had for doing this is that there's a way to forward additional keys that I have so you can talk to me no matter what device I'm on. And one of the bugs, there were a bunch in this paper here, was that when receiving keys, the clients didn't check correctly who they were forwarded from. So the functionality that was supposed to let me say for my phone, oh, you should also be able to send messages to my desktop, also let some attacker say, oh, you should also send messages to this guy to my desktop. Because the clients weren't checking correctly who sent the extra keys to use. Questions on these sort of other examples of the cryptography is fine, but something else is broken attacks. So next week, we're going to have a lab on secure communication. And in the lab, we're going to be doing things like that replay attack. And the interface we're going to provide in the lab is that you're going to implement a function that is forward. And we're going to represent the message as a struct. And the default version of this just sends the message unchanged without sending any additional messages. But the idea here is that you're going to be playing the active attacker M. So you can change the message before you send it. You can replace it with a different message. And so on. The restrictions you have are that, well, the messages sometimes will use encryption and digital signatures, and you can't just decrypt everything that isn't encrypted to you or sign things other than as your public key. Okay, so questions on what's in the lab next week? Yes, I guess I should play more. And as you see in the lab write-up, sort of all the scenarios we have in the lab write-up are kind of versions of not that one. This scenario where A and B are sending messages where A is asking B to pay a certain amount of money, and your goal is to make that amount of money wrong. Any questions, follow-ups? Okay, so we're gonna have a few other topics we're gonna talk about in more detail next time. And the big problem here we're gonna try to deal with are some of those practicality problems, that if my web browser can talk to websites securely, somehow we need the public keys for every single web page, but clearly, you know, even though my web browser download has gotten bigger, it hasn't gotten that much bigger. And it hasn't needed updates that frequently. So we have to have some other way of getting all these public keys we need, you know, for all these different people to us. And the key insight we're going to rely upon is something known as a certificate. So rather than sending the, sending you all the public keys in advance, we're going to send you the public key of someone you trust. And they're going to forward it. So let's say A has B's public key, and C wants B's public key and knows A. What A can do is send a message to C with the public key. And I, again, am not doing this right. Why did I mess that up? So A can send a message with the B's public key, and if B, so C has A's public key already, A can sign that message. So it can send a signature for the promise that A is, verify that B's public key is XXX in this case. So we send a signature, and that means that C knows that A genuinely created that message. So as far as A is concerned, that's what B's public key is. And this message here, this is known as a certificate. And the idea here is that as long as C trusts A, which is a big ask, yeah, it's a problem, but if C trusts A, that means now C can communicate securely with B without having A be involved anymore. And this principle is how sort of our internet sort of secure communication works, is that we rely on these certificates to build up talking securely to websites and most other contexts where we have secure communication with a lot of potential people. Okay, so that's where I'll leave off today. We'll talk more about certificates and also a bit about how, actual TLS works.